such eyes. Breton approaches her. She smiles, but quite mysteriously and somehow knowingly. In L'Amour Fou, Mad Love, this young woman who just entered appeared to be swathed in mist, clothed in fire, and I can certainly say that here, on the 29th of May, 1934, this woman was scandalously beautiful. The poet immediately admits she has a role to play in his destiny. At times, this is a fleeting, secondary role, such as the child with Delilah's eyes in Les Vases Communicants, Communicating Vessels, even when tiny miracles emerge around her. The same day Breton has a rendezvous with this Delilah, he reads a good review written by a friend called Samson, with whom he had not been in touch for a long time. Sometimes wonders occur. The unknown woman of May 29th, Ondine, who had a swimming piece in her music hall act, was presaged by a pun heard in a restaurant. Ondine one dines, and her first long date with the poet had been described in great detail in a poem he wrote 11 years earlier. Nadia is the most extraordinary of these sorceresses. She predicts the future, and from her lips spring forth words and images her friend has in mind at the very same instant. Her dreams and drawings are oracles. "I am the soul in limbo," she says. She went forward in life with behavior based as it was on the purest intuition alone and ceaselessly relying on miracle. Around her, objective chance spreads strange events. She is so marvelously liberated from appearances that she scorns laws and reasons. She ends up in an asylum. She is a free genius, something like one of those spirits of the air which certain magical practices momentarily permit us to entertain, but which we can never overcome. This prevents her from fulfilling her feminine role completely. Medium, prophetess, inspiration, she remains too close to the unreal creatures that visited Nerval. She opens the doors to the surreal world, but she is unable to give it because she could not give herself. Woman accomplishes herself and is really transformed in love, unique, accepting a unique destiny, and not floating rootless through the universe. So she is the sum of all. The moment her beauty reaches its highest point is at night, when she is the perfect mirror in which everything that has been and everything that is destined to be is suffused adorably in what is going to be this time. For Breton, finding the place and the formula is one with possessing the truth within one soul and one body. Note, Arthur Rimbaud, Vagabonds, in Illumination and Adieu, Farewell, in Une Saison en Enfer, A Season in Hell, translation. And this possession is only possible in reciprocal love, carnal love, of course. The portrait of the woman one loves must be not only an image one smiles at, but even more an oracle one questions. But oracle only if this very woman is something other than an idea or an image. She must be the keystone of the material world. For the seer, this is the same world as poetry, and in this world he has to really possess Beatrice. Reciprocal love alone is what conditions total magnetic attraction, which nothing can affect, which makes flesh sun and splendid impression on the flesh, which makes spirit a forever flowing stream, inalterable and alive, whose water moves once and for all between marigold and wild thyme. This indestructible love can only be unique. It is the paradox of Breton's attitude that from Communicating Vessels to Arcanum 17, he is determined to promise love both unique and eternal to different women. But according to him, it is social circumstances thwarting the freedom of his choice that lead man into erroneous choices. In fact, through these errors, he is really looking for one woman. And if he remembers the faces he has loved, he will discover at the same time in all these women's faces, one face only, the last face loved. How many times, moreover, have I noticed that under extremely dissimilar appearances, one exceptional trait was developing? He asks Ondine in Mad Love, Are you at last this woman? Is it only today you were to come? But in Arcanum 17, you know very well that when I first laid eyes on you, I recognized you without the slightest hesitation. In a completed, renewed world, the couple would be indissoluble, through an absolute and reciprocal gift. Since the beloved is all, how could there be any room for another? She is also this other, and all the more fully as she is more herself. The unusual is inseparable from love. Because you are unique, you can't help being for me always another, another you. Across the diversity of these inconceivable flowers over there, it is you over there changing whom I love in a red blouse, naked, in a gray blouse. And about a different but equally unique woman, Breton wrote, reciprocal love, such as I envisage it, is a system of mirrors which reflects for me under the thousand angles that the unknown can take for me, the faithful image of the one I love, always more surprising in her divining of my own desire, and more gilded with life. This unique woman, both carnal and artificial, natural and human, casts the same spell as the equivocal objects loved by the surrealists. She is like the spoon shoe, the table magnifying glass, the sugar cube of marble that the poet discovers at the flea market or invents in a dream. She shares in the secret of familiar objects suddenly discovered in their truth, and the secret of plants and stones. She is all things. My love, whose hair is woodfire, her thoughts heat lightning, her hourglass waste, my love whose sex is algae and sweets of yore, my love of savannah eyes. But she is beauty, above and beyond every other thing. Beauty, for Breton, is not an idea one contemplates, but a reality that reveals itself, and therefore exists. Only through passion, only through woman, does beauty exist in the world. And it is there, right in the depths of the human crucible, in this paradoxical region where the fusion of two beings who have really chosen each other renders to all things the lost colors of the times of ancient suns, where, however, loneliness rages also, in one of nature's fantasies which, around the Alaskan craters, demands that under the ashes there remain snow. It is there that years ago I asked that we look for a new beauty, a beauty envisaged exclusively to produce passion. Convulsive beauty will be veiled erotic, fixed explosive, magic circumstantial, or it will not be. It is from woman that everything that is derives meaning. Love and love alone is precisely what the fusion of essence and existence realizes to the highest degree. It is accomplished for lovers and thus throughout the whole world. The recreation, the perpetual recoloration of the world in a single being, such as they are accomplished through love, light up with a thousand rays the advance of the earth ahead. For all poets, or almost all, woman embodies nature. But for Breton, she not only expresses it, she delivers it. Because nature does not speak in a clear language, its mysteries have to be penetrated in order to grasp its truth, which is the same thing as its beauty. Poetry is not simply the reflection of it, but rather its key, and woman here cannot be differentiated from poetry. That is why she is the indispensable mediator without whom the whole earth would be silenced. Nature is likely to light up and to fade out, to serve and not to serve me, only to the extent that I feel the rise and the fall of the fire of a hearth, which is love, the only love, that for a single being, it was only lacking for a great iris of fire to emerge from me to give its value to what exists. I contemplate to the point of dizziness your hands opened above the fire of twigs which we just kindled and which is now raging, your enchanting hands, your transparent hands hovering over the fire of my life. Every woman loved is a natural wonder for Breton. A tiny, unforgettable fern climbing the inside wall of an ancient well. something so blinding and serious that she could not but bring to mind the great natural physical necessity, while at the same time tenderly dreaming of the nonchalance of some tall flowers beginning to blossom. But inversely, every natural wonder merges with the beloved. He exalts her when he waxes emotional about a grotto, a flower, a mountain. Between the woman who warms his hands on a landing of Teide and Teide itself, all distance is abolished. The poet invokes both in one prayer. Wonderful Teide, take my life, mouth of the heavens and yet mouth of hell. I prefer you thus in your enigma, able to send natural beauty to the skies and to swallow up everything. Beauty is even more than beauty. It fuses with the deep night of knowledge. It is truth and eternity, the absolute. Woman does not deliver a temporal and contingent aspect of the world. She is the necessary essence of it, not a fixed essence as Plato imagined it, but a fixed explosive one. The only treasure I find in myself is the key that opens this limitless field since I have known you, this field made of the repetition of one plant, taller and taller, swinging in a wider and wider arc, and leading me to death. Because one woman and one man, who until the end of time must be you and me, will drift in their turn without ever turning back, as far as the path goes, in the optical glow, at the edges of life and of the oblivion of life. The greatest hope, I mean the one encompassing all the others, is that this be for all people, and that for all people this lasts, that the absolute gift of one being to another who cannot exist without his reciprocity be in the eyes of all the only natural and supernatural bridge spanning life. Through the love she inspires and shares, woman is thus the only possible salvation for each man. In Arcanum 17, her mission spreads and takes shape. She has to save humanity. Breton has always been part of the Fourier tradition that, demanding rehabilitation of the flesh, exalts woman as erotic object. It is logical that he should come to the Saint Simonian idea of the regenerating woman. In today's society, the male dominates to such an extent that it is an insult for someone like Gourmand to say of Rimbaud, a girl's temperament. However, the time has come to value the ideas of woman at the expense of those of man, whose bankruptcy is coming to pass fairly tumultuously today. Yes, it is always the lost woman, she who sings in man's imagination, but after such trials for her and for him, it must also be the woman retrieved. And first of all, woman has to retrieve herself. She has to learn to recognize herself through the hells she is destined to by the more than problematic view that man, in general, carries of her. The role she should fill is above all that of pacifier. I've always been stupefied that she didn't make her voice heard, that she didn't think of taking every possible advantage, the immense advantage of the two irresistible and priceless inflections given to her. One for talking to men during love, the other that commands all of a child's trust. What clout, what future would this great cry of warning and refusal from woman have had? When will we see a woman simply as woman perform quite a different miracle of extending her arms between those who are about to grapple to say, "You are brothers"? If woman today looks ill-adapted or off-balance, it is due to the treatment masculine tyranny has inflicted on her. But she maintains a miraculous power because her roots plunge deep into the wellspring of life whose secrets males have lost. Melusina, half-reclaimed by panic-stricken life, Melusina with lower joints of broken stones, aquatic plants, or the down of a nest, she's the one I invoke. She's the only one I can see who could redeem this savage epic. She's all of woman, and yet woman as she exists today, woman deprived of her human base, prisoner of her mobile roots, if you will, but also through them in providential communication with nature's elemental forces. Woman deprived of her human base, legend has it, by the impatience and jealousy of man. So today, one has to be on woman's side, while waiting for her real worth to be restored to her. Those of us in the arts must pronounce ourselves unequivocally against man and for woman. The child woman, systematically art must prepare her advent into the empire of tangible things. Why child woman? Breton explains. I choose the child woman not in order to oppose her to other women, but because it seems to me that in her and in her alone exists in a state of absolute transparency the other prism of vision. Insofar as woman is merely assimilated to a human being, she will be as unable as male human beings to save the doomed world. It is femininity as such that introduces this other element, the truth of life and poetry, into civilization. And that alone can free humanity. As Breton's view is exclusively poetic, it is exclusively as poetry and thus as other that woman is envisaged. If one were to ask about her own destiny, the response would be implied in the ideal of reciprocal love. Her only vocation is love. This is in no way inferiority, since man's vocation is also love. However, one would like to know whether for her as well, love is the key to the world, the revelation of beauty. Will she find this beauty in her lover or in her own image? Will she be capable of the poetic activity that makes poetry happen through a sentient being, or will she be limited to approving her male's work? She is poetry itself, in the immediate, that is, for man. We are not told whether she is poetry for herself, too. Breton does not speak of woman as subject, nor does he ever evoke the image of the bad woman. In his work as a whole, in spite of a few manifestos and pamphlets in which he vilifies the human herd, he focuses not on categorizing the world's superficial resistances, but on revealing the secret truth. Woman interests him only because she is a privileged mouth. Deeply anchored in nature, very close to the earth, she also appears to be the key to the beyond. One finds in Breton the same esoteric naturalism as in the Gnostics, who saw in Sophia the principle of redemption and even of creation, as in Dante choosing Beatrice for guide, or Petrarch illuminated by Laura's love. That is why the being most rooted in nature, the closest to the earth, is also the key to the beyond. Truth, beauty, poetry. She is all. Once more all in the figure of the other. All, except herself. 5. Stendhal or Romancing the Real. If now, leaving the present period, I return to Stendhal, it is because leaving behind these carnivals where woman is disguised as shrew, nymph, morning star, or mermaid, I find it reassuring to approach a man who lives among flesh and blood women. Stendhal loved women sensually from childhood. He projected the hopes of his adolescence onto them. He readily imagined himself saving a beautiful stranger and winning her love. Once he was in Paris, what he wanted the most ardently was a charming wife. We will adore each other. She will know my soul. Grown old, he writes the initials of the women he loved the most in the dust. I believe that dreaming was what I preferred above all, he admits, and his dreams are nourished by images of women. His memories of them enliven the countryside. The line of rocks when approaching Arbois and coming from Dole by the main road was, I believe, a touching and clear image for me of Mathilde's soul. Music, painting, architecture, everything he cherished it with an unlucky lover's soul. While he is walking around Rome, a woman emerges at every turn of the page. By the regrets, desires, sadnesses, and joys women awakened in him, he came to know the nature of his own heart. It is women he wants as judges. He frequents their salons. He wants to shine. He owes them his greatest joys. his greatest pain. They were his main occupation. He prefers their love to any friendship, their friendship to that of men. Women inspire his books. Female figures populate them. He writes in great part for them. I might be lucky enough to be read in 1900 by the souls I love, the Madame Rolands, the Mélanie Guiberts. They were the very substance of his life. Where did this privilege come from? This tender friend of women, and precisely because he loves them and their truth, does not believe in feminine mystery. There is no essence that defines woman once and for all. The idea of an eternal feminine seems pedantic and ridiculous to him. Pedants have been repeating for 2,000 years that women have quicker minds and men more solidity, that women have more subtlety in ideas and men more attention span. A Parisian passerby walking around the Versailles Gardens once concluded that from everything he saw, the trees are born pruned. The differences that one notices between men and women reflect those of their situation. For example, how could women not be more romantic than their lovers? A woman at her embroidery frame, insipid work that only involves her hands, dreams of her lover, who, galloping around the countryside with his troop, is put under arrest if he makes one false move. Likewise, women are accused of lacking common sense. Women prefer emotions to reason. This is so simple, as they are not given responsibility for any family affair by virtue of our pedestrian customs. Reason is never useful to them. Let your wife settle your affairs with the farmers on two of your lands, and I wager that the books are better kept than by you. If so few female geniuses are found in history, it is because society denies them any means of expression. All the geniuses who are born women are lost for the public good. When chance offers them the means to prove themselves, watch them attain the most difficult skills. The worst handicap they have to bear is the deadening education they are given. The oppressor always attempts to diminish those he oppresses. Man intentionally refuses women their chances. We allow their most brilliant qualities and the ones richest in happiness for themselves and for us to remain idle. At 10 years of age, the girl is quicker, subtler than her brother. At 20, the scamp is a quick-witted adult, and the girl, a big, awkward idiot, shy and afraid of a spider. At fault is the training she has received. Women should be given exactly as much education as boys. Anti-feminists object that cultured and intelligent women are monsters. The whole problem comes from the fact that they are still exceptional. If all women had equal access to culture as naturally as men, they would just as naturally take advantage of it. After having been mutilated, they are then subjected to laws against nature. Married against their hearts, they are supposed to be faithful, and even divorce is reproached as wild behavior. A great number of them are destined to idleness, when the fact is that there is no happiness without work. This condition scandalizes Stendhal, and therein he finds the source of all the faults blamed on women. They are neither angels, nor demons, nor sphinx, but human beings reduced to semi-slavery by idiotic customs. It is precisely because they are oppressed that the best of them will avoid the faults that tarnish their oppressors. In themselves, they are neither inferior nor superior to man, but by a curious reversal, their unfortunate situation works in their favor. It is well known that Stendhal hates the spirit of seriousness. Note, L'esprit de sérieux, conventional thinking, translation. Money, honors, rank, and power are the saddest of idols to him. The immense majority of men alienate themselves in their pursuit. The pedant, the self-important man, the bourgeois, and the husband stifle in themselves any spark of life and truth. Armed with preconceived ideas and learned feelings, obeying social routines, they are inhabited only by emptiness. A world populated with these creatures without a soul is a desert of boredom. There are unfortunately many women who stagnate in these dismal swamps. They are dolls with narrow and Parisian ideas, or else self-righteous hypocrites. Stendhal experiences a mortal disgust for decent women and the hypocrisy that is indispensable to them. They bring to their frivolous occupations the same seriousness that represses their husbands. Stupid through education, envious, vain, talkative, mean through idleness, cold, emotionless, pretentious, harmful. They populate Paris and the provinces. They can be seen swarming about behind the noble figure of a Madame de Rênal or a Madame de Chastelet. The one Stendhal depicted with the most bitter care is undoubtedly Madame Grandet, the exact negative of a Madame Roland or a Mathilde. Beautiful but expressionless, condescending and without charm, she intimidates by her famous virtue, but does not know real modesty, which comes from the soul. Full of admiration for self, imbued with her own personage, she only knows how to copy grandeur from the outside. Deep down inside, she is vulgar and inferior. She has no character. She bores me, thinks Monsieur Louvain. Perfectly reasonable, concerned by the success of her projects, she focuses all of her ambition on making her husband a minister. Her mind was arid. Careful and conformist, she always kept herself from love. She is incapable of a generous movement. When passion sets into this dry soul, it burns without illuminating her. It is only necessary to reverse this image to discover what Stendhal asks of women. First, not to fall prey to the traps of seriousness. Because the supposedly important things are out of their reach, women risk alienating themselves in them less than men. They have a better chance of preserving this natural side, this naivete, this generosity that Stendhal places higher than any other merit. What he appreciates in them is what we would call today their authenticity. That is the common trait of all the women he loved or invented with love. All are free and true beings. For some, their freedom is strikingly visible. Angela Pietragrua, sublime whore, Italian style, a la Lucrezia Borgia, and Madame Azur, whore a la Du Barry, one of the least doll-like French women that I have met, oppose social custom openly. Lamiel laughs at conventions, customs, and laws. Sanseverina throws herself ardently into the intrigue and does not stop at crime. Others rise above the vulgar through the vigor of their minds, like Menta or Mathilde de la Mole, who criticizes, denigrates, and scorns the society that surrounds her and wants to stand apart from it. For others, freedom takes a wholly negative form. What is remarkable in Madame de Chastelet is her indifference to everything secondary. Subjected to her father's will and even his opinions, she still manages to contest bourgeois values by means of the indifference she is criticized for as childish, and that is the source of her carefree gaiety. Clélia Conti also stands apart by her reserve. Balls and other traditional entertainments for girls leave her cold. She always seems distant, either out of scorn for what surrounds her or out of regret for some missing chimera. She judges the world. She takes offense at its indignities. Madame de Rênal is the one whose soul's independence is the most deeply hidden. She herself does not know she is not really resigned to her lot. Her extreme delicacy and acute sensitivity show her repugnance for her milieu's vulgarity. She is without hypocrisy. She has kept a generous heart, capable of violent emotions, and she has the taste for happiness. The fire that smolders barely gives off any heat, but only a breath is needed for it to be fully kindled. These women are simply living. They know the source of real values is not in exterior things, but in the heart. That is what makes the charm of the world they inhabit. They chase away boredom merely by being present with their dreams, desires, pleasures, emotions, and inventions. Sanseverina, that active soul, dreads boredom more than death. Stagnating in boredom is preventing one from dying, she said. It is not living. She is always totally involved in something, always active, always gay. Foolhardy, childish, or deep, gay or serious, reckless or secretive, they all refuse the heavy sleep in which humanity sinks. And these women who have been able to preserve their freedom, albeit unfulfilled, will rise up by passion to heroism as soon as they meet an object worthy of them. Their force of soul and their energy attest to the fierce purity of total commitment. But freedom alone would not be sufficient to endow them with so many romantic attractions. A pure freedom inspires esteem, but not emotion. What is touching is their effort to accomplish themselves in spite of the obstacles that beleaguer them. It creates even more pathos in women because the struggle is more difficult. The victory over exterior constraints is sufficient to enchant Stendhal. In Chroniques Italiennes, Three Italian Chronicles, he cloisters his heroines in remote convents. He locks them up in a jealous spouse's palace. They have to invent 1,000 tricks to meet their lovers. Secret doors, rope ladders, bloody chests, kidnappings, sequestrations, and assassinations. The unleashing of passion and disobedience is served by an ingenuity in which all the mind's resources are displayed. Death and the threat of tortures highlight even more the daringness of the deranged souls he depicts. Even in his more mature work, Stendhal remains sympathetic to this external expression of the romantic. It is the manifestation of the one born from the heart. They cannot be distinguished from each other, just as a mouth cannot be separated from its smile. Clélia invents love anew by inventing the alphabet that allows her to correspond with Fabrice. Sanseverina is described to us as a soul always sincere, who never acts with caution, who totally gives herself over to the impression of the moment. It is when she schemes, when she poisons the prince and floods Parma, that this soul is revealed to us. She is no other than the sublime and mad escapade that she has chosen to live. The letter that Mathilde de la Mole leans against her window is much more than a prop. Her proud recklessness, her penchant for the extraordinary, and her provocative courage take a tangible form. The qualities of these souls would not be revealed were they not surrounded by enemies, prison walls, a lord's will, and a family's harshness. But the most difficult constraints to overcome are those that one finds in oneself. Then the adventure of freedom is the most uncertain, the most poignant, and the most piquant. Clearly, the more often Stendhal's heroines are prisoners, the greater his sympathy for them. Yes, he enjoys whores, sublime or not, who have once and for all trampled on the conventions, but he cherishes Mathilde more tenderly, restrained by her scruples and modesty. Lucien Louvain is happy when near Madame d'Aucincourt, that liberated person. But it is Madame de Chastelet, chaste, reserved, and hesitant, that he loves passionately. Fabrice admires the undivided soul of Sanseverina that stops at nothing. But he prefers Clélia, and it is the young girl who wins his heart. And Madame de Rênal, bound by her pride, her prejudices, and her ignorance, is perhaps the most astonishing of all the women Stendhal created. He readily places his heroines in the provinces, in a confined milieu, under the authority of a husband or a foolish father. It pleases him that they are uneducated, and even full of false ideas. Madame de Rênal and Madame de Chastelet are both obstinately legitimist. The former is a timid mind and without experience. The latter is a brilliant intelligence, but she underestimates its worth. They are therefore not responsible for their errors, but they are the victims of them as much as of institutions and social customs. And it is from error that romance springs forth, as poetry is born from failure. A lucid mind that decides on its actions in full knowledge is approved or blamed coldly, whereas the courage and ruses of a generous heart seeking its way in the shadows are admired with fear, pity, irony, or love. It is because women are mystified that useless and charming qualities such as their modesty, pride, and extreme delicacy flourish. In one sense, these are defects. They lead to lies, susceptibilities, and anger. But they can be explained by the situation in which women are placed. It leads them to take pride in little things, or at least in things determined by feeling, because all the supposedly important objects are out of their reach. Their modesty results from the dependence they suffer. Because it is forbidden to them to show their worth in action, it is their very being that they put into question. It seems to them that the other's consciousness, and particularly that of their lover, reveals them in their truth. They are afraid. They try to escape it. In their evasions, their hesitations, their revolts, and even their lies, an authentic concern for worth is expressed. That is what makes them respectable. But it is expressed awkwardly, even with bad faith, and that makes them touching and even discreetly comic. When freedom is hoist by its own petard and cheats on itself, it is at the most deeply human, and so in Stendhal's eyes, at its most endearing. Stendhal's women are imbued with pathos when their hearts pose unexpected problems for them. No outside law, recipe, reasoning, or example can then guide them. They have to decide alone. This abandon is the extreme moment of freedom. Clélia is brought up with liberal ideas. She is lucid and reasonable, but learned opinions, whether right or wrong, are of no help in a moral conflict. Madame de Rênal loves Julien in spite of his morality. Clélia saves Fabrice in spite of herself. In both cases, there is the same surpassing of all accepted values. This daring is what exalts Stendhal, but is even more moving because it barely dares to declare itself. It is all the more natural, spontaneous, and authentic. In Madame de Rênal, boldness is hidden by innocence. Because she does not know love, she does not recognize it, and yields to it without resistance. One could say that having lived in darkness, she is defenseless against the violent light of passion. She welcomes it, blinded even against God, against hell. When this fire goes out, she falls back in the shadows that husbands and priests govern. She does not trust her own judgment, but the evidence overwhelms her. As soon as she sees Julien again, she once more unburdens her soul to him. Her remorse and the letter her confessor wrests from her show the distance this ardent and sincere soul had to span to tear herself away from the prison society enclosed her in and accede to the heaven of happiness. The conflict is more conscious for Clélia. She hesitates between loyalty to her father and pity inspired by love. She is searching for a rationale. The triumph of the values in which Stendhal believes is all the more striking to him in that this triumph is experienced as a defeat by the victims of a hypocritical civilization. And he delights in seeing them use ruses and bad faith to make the truth of passion and happiness prevail against the lies in which they believe. Clélia, promising the Madonna to no longer see Fabrice and accepting his kisses and his embraces for 2 years, providing she closes her eyes, is both laughable and heartbreaking. Stendhal considers Madame de Chastelet's hesitations and Mathilde de la Mole's inconsistencies with the same tender irony. So many detours, changes of mind, scruples, victories, and hidden defeats in order to reach simple and legitimate ends is for him the most delightful of comedies. There is drollery in these dramas because the actress is both judge and party, because she is her own dupe, and because she burdens herself with complicated paths where a decree would suffice for the Gordian knot to be cut. But they nonetheless show the most respectable concern that could torture a noble soul. She wants to remain worthy of her own esteem. She places her own approbation higher than that of others, and thus she realizes herself as an absolute. These solitary debates without reverberation have more gravity than a ministerial crisis. When she wonders if she is going to respond to Lucien Louvain's love or not, Madame de Chastelet decides for herself and the world. Can one have confidence in others? Can one trust one's own heart? What is the value of love and human vows? Is it mad or generous to believe and to love? These questions challenge the very meaning of life, that of each and every one. The so-called important man is futile, in fact, because he accepts ready-made justifications of his life. While a passionate and deep woman revises established values at each instant, she knows the constant tension of an unassisted freedom. Thus, she feels herself in constant danger. She can win or lose everything in a second. It is this risk, accepted with apprehension, that gives her story the color of a heroic adventure. And the stakes are the highest that can be. The very meaning of this existence, of which everyone has a share, his only part. Mina de Vongel's escapade can seem absurd in one sense, but she brings it to a whole ethic. Was her life a false calculation? Her happiness lasted 8 months. She had too ardent a soul to settle for the real life. Mathilde de la Mole is less sincere than Clélia or Madame de Chastelet. She orders her acts on the idea she has of herself rather than on the evidence of love and happiness. Is it more arrogant, grander to keep oneself than to lose oneself, to humiliate oneself before one's beloved than to resist him? She is alone with her doubts, and she risks the self-esteem that is more important to her than life itself. It is the ardent quest for the real reasons to live through the shadows of ignorance, prejudice, and mystifications in the wavering and feverish light of passion. It is the infinite risk of happiness or death, of grandeur or shame, that gives romantic glory to these women's destinies. The woman is, of course, unaware of the seduction she radiates. Self-contemplation and play-acting are always inauthentic attitudes. By the mere fact of comparing herself to Madame Roland, Madame Grandet proves she does not resemble her. If Mathilde de la Mole continues to be endearing, it is because she gets confused in her play-acting and is often prey to her heart just when she thinks she governs it. She moves us insofar as she is not ruled by her will. But the purest of heroines lack consciousness of themselves. Madame de Rênal is unaware of her grace, just as Madame de Chastelet is of her intelligence. It is one of the deep joys of the lover with whom the author and the reader identify. He is the witness through whom these secret riches are revealed. The vivacity Madame de Rênal deploys out of everyone's sight, the bright wit, changing and deep, unknown to Madame de Chastelet's milieu, he alone admires them. And even if others appreciate Sanseverina's wit, he is the one who penetrates the deepest into her soul. Faced with the woman, the man tastes the pleasure of contemplation. She intoxicates him like a landscape or a painting. She sings in his heart and lights up the sky. This revelation reveals him to himself. One cannot understand women's delicacy, their sensibilities, and their ardor without developing a delicate, sensitive, and ardent soul oneself. Female feelings create a world of nuances and requirements whose discovery enriches the lover. When with Madame de Rênal, Julien becomes someone other than the ambitious man he had decided to be, he chooses himself anew. If the man has only a superficial desire for the woman, he will find seducing her amusing. But it is real love that will transfigure his life. Love à la Werther opens the soul to feeling and pleasure in the beautiful, in whatever form it takes, even in a hair shirt. It makes happiness attainable even without wealth. It is a new aim in life to which everything is connected and that changes the appearance of everything. Love as passion throws in man's eyes all of nature with its sublime aspects as if it were a novelty invented yesterday. Love shatters daily routine, chases away boredom. The boredom in which Stendhal sees such a deep evil because it is the absence of all the reasons for living or dying. The lover has an aim, and that is enough for each day to become an adventure. What a pleasure for Stendhal to spend 3 days hidden in Mentes cellar. Rope ladders and bloody chests represent this taste for the extraordinary in his novels. Love, that is woman, reveals the real ends of the existence. Beauty, happiness, the freshness of feelings and of the world. It tears man's soul out, and thus gives him possession of it. The lover experiences the same tension, the same risks, as his mistress, and feels himself more authentically than during a planned career. When Julien hesitates at the base of the ladder Mathilde has set up, he puts his whole destiny into question. In that very moment, he demonstrates his true worth. It is through women, under their influence, in reaction to their behavior, that Julien, Fabrice, and Lucienne learn about the world and themselves. Test, reward, judge, or friend. The woman in Stendhal is really what Hegel was once tempted to make of her. That other consciousness that, in reciprocal recognition, gives to the other subject the same truth it receives from it. The happy couple that recognizes each other in love defies the universe and time. It is sufficient in itself. It realizes the absolute. But this supposes that woman is not pure alterity. She is subject herself. Stendhal never describes his heroines as a function of his heroes. He provides them with their own destinies. He undertook something rarer and that no other novelist, I think, has ever done. He projected himself into a female character. He does not examine Lamiel as Marivaux does Marianne, or Richardson does Clarissa Harlowe. He shares her destiny as he had shared that of Julien. Precisely because of that, the character of Lamiel is singularly significant, if somewhat theoretical. Stendhal sets up all imaginable obstacles around the girl. She is a peasant, poor, ignorant, and brought up harshly by people imbued with every prejudice. But she eliminates from her path all the moral barriers the day she understands the scope of these little words. It's stupid. Her mind's freedom enables her to take responsibility for all the movements of her curiosity, her ambition, her gaiety. Faced with such a resolute heart, material obstacles cannot fail to decrease. Her only problem will be to carve out a destiny worthy of her in a mediocre world. That destiny accomplishes itself in crime and death, but that is also Julien's lot. There is no place for great souls in society as it is. Men and women are in the same boat. It is remarkable that Stendhal is both so profoundly romantic and so decidedly feminist. Feminists are usually rational minds that adopt a universal point of view in all things. But it is not only in the name of freedom in general, but also in the name of individual happiness that Stendhal calls for women's emancipation. Love, he thinks, will have nothing to lose. On the contrary, it will be all the truer that woman, as the equal of man, will be able to understand him more completely. Undoubtedly, some of the qualities one enjoys in woman will disappear, but their value comes from the freedom that is expressed in them and that will show in other guises. And the romantic will not fade out of this world. Two separate beings, placed in different situations, confronting each other in their freedom and seeking the justification of existence through each other, will always live an adventure full of risks and promises. Stendhal trusts the truth. As soon as one flees it, one dies a living death. But where it shines, so shine beauty, happiness, love, and a joy that carries in it its own justification. That is why he rejects the false poetry of myths as much as the mystifications of seriousness. Human reality is sufficient for him. Woman, according to him, is simply a human being. Dreams could not invent anything more intoxicating. 6. These examples show that the great collective myths are reflected in each singular writer. Woman appears to us as flesh. Male flesh is engendered by the maternal womb and recreated in the woman lover's embrace. Thus, woman is akin to nature. She embodies it. Animal, little veil of blood, rose in bloom, siren, curve of a hill. She gives humus, sap, tangible beauty, and the world's soul to man. She can hold the keys to poetry. She can be mediator between this world and the beyond. Grace or Pythia, star or witch, she opens the door to the supernatural, the surreal. She is destined to eminence, and through her passivity, she doles out peace and harmony. But should she refuse this role, she becomes praying mantis or ogress. In any case, she appears as the privileged other through whom the subject accomplishes himself. One of the measures of man, his balance, his salvation, his adventure, and his happiness. But these myths are orchestrated differently for each individual. The other is singularly defined according to the singular way the one chooses to posit himself. All men assert themselves as freedom and transcendence, but they do not all give the same meaning to these words. For Montholon, transcendence is a state. He is the transcendent. He soars in the sky of heroes. The woman crouches on the ground under his feet. He enjoys measuring the distance separating him from her. From time to time, he raises her to him, takes and then rejects her. Never does he lower himself toward her sphere of viscous darkness. Lawrence situates transcendence in the phallus. The phallus is life and power only thanks to woman. Immanence is thus good and necessary. The false hero who deigns not to touch the earth, far from being a demigod, fails to be a man. Woman is not despicable. She is deep wealth, hot spring, but she must renounce all personal transcendence and settle for nourishing that of her male. Claudel demands the same devotion. Woman is also for him the one who maintains life, while man prolongs the vital momentum by his activity. But for the Catholic, everything that occurs on earth is steeped in vain immanence. The only transcendent is God. In God's eyes, the active man and the woman who serves him are exactly equal. Each one has to surpass his earthly condition. Salvation, in any case, is an autonomous undertaking. For Breton, sexual hierarchy is inverted. Action and conscious thought, in which the male situates his transcendence, are for him a banal mystification that engenders war, stupidity, bureaucracy, and negation of the human. It is immanence, the pure opaque presence of the real, that is the truth. True transcendence would be accomplished by the return to immanence. His attitude is the exact opposite of Montholon's. The latter likes war because women are banished from it. Breton venerates woman because she brings peace. One confuses mind and subjectivity. He rejects the given universe. The other thinks the mind is objectively present in the heart of the world. Woman compromises Montholon because she shatters his solitude. She is, for Breton, revelation, because she wrests him from subjectivity. As for Stendhal, we saw that woman barely takes on a mythical value for him. He considers her as also being a transcendence. For this humanist, it is in their reciprocal relations that freedoms are accomplished, and it is sufficient that the other is simply another for life to have, according to him, a little spice. He does not seek a stellar equilibrium. He does not nourish himself with the bread of disgust. He does not expect miracles. He wishes to concern himself not with the cosmos or poetry, but with freedoms. That is, he also experiences himself as a translucent freedom. The others, and this is one of the most important points, posit themselves as transcendences, but feel they are prisoners of an opaque presence in their own hearts. They project onto woman this unbreakable core of night. In Montholon, there is an Adlerian complex where heavy bad faith is born. These pretensions and fears are what he incarnates in woman. The disgust he feels for her is what he fears to feel for himself. He intends to trample in her the ever-possible proof of his own insufficiency. He asks scorn to save him. Woman is the ditch in which he throws all the monsters that inhabit him. Note: Stendhal judged in advance the cruelties with which Montholon amuses himself. In indifference, what should be done? Love taste, but without the horrors. The horrors always come from a little soul that needs reassurance of its own merits. Lawrence's life shows us that he suffered from an analogous complex, but more purely sexual. Woman in his work has the value of a compensatory myth. Through her is found an exalted virility of which the writer was not very sure. When he describes Kate at Don Cipriano's feet, he believes he has won a male triumph over Frida, nor does he accept that his female companion challenges him. If she contested his aims, he would probably lose confidence in them. Her role is to reassure him. He asks for peace, rest, and faith from her, just as Montholon asks for the certitude of his superiority. They demand what they lack. Self-confidence is not lacking in Claudel. If he is shy, it is only the secret of God. Thus, there is no trace of the battle of the sexes. Man bravely takes on the weight of woman. She is the possibility of temptation or of salvation. For Breton, it seems that man is only true through the mystery that inhabits him. It pleases him that Nadia sees that star he is going toward, and that is like a heartless flower. His dreams, intuitions, and the spontaneous unfolding of his inner language. It is in these activities that are out of the control of will and reason that he recognizes himself. Woman is the tangible figure of this veiled presence, infinitely more essential than her conscious personality. As for Stendhal, he quietly coincides with himself, but he needs woman as she does him, so that his dispersed existence is gathered in the unity of a figure and a destiny. It is as for another that the human being reaches being, but another still has to lend him his consciousness. Other men are too indifferent to their peers. Only the woman in love opens her heart to her lover and shelters it in its entirety. Except for Claudel, who finds a perfect witness in God, all the writers we have considered expect, in Malraux's words, woman to cherish in them this incomparable monster known to themselves alone. In collaboration or combat, men come up against each other in their generality. Montholon, for his peers, is a writer. Lawrence, a doctrinaire. Breton, a leader of a school. Stendhal, a diplomat or a man of wit. It is women who reveal in one a magnificent and cruel prince, in another, a disturbing animal, in still another, a god or a sun, or a being, black and cold, like a man struck by lightning, lying at the feet of the Sphinx. Note, Nadia. And in the other, a seducer, a charmer, a lover. For each of them, the ideal woman will be she who embodies the most exactly the other, able to reveal him to himself. Montholon, the solar spirit, looks for pure animality in her. Lawrence, the phallic, demands that she sum up the female sex in its generality. Claudel defines her as a soul sister. Breton cherishes Melusina rooted in nature. He puts his hopes in the child woman. Stendhal wants his mistress intelligent, cultivated, free of spirit and morals, an equal. But the only earthly destiny reserved to the woman equal, child woman, soul sister, woman sex, and female animal is always man. Regardless of the ego looking for itself through her, it can only attain itself if she consents to be his crucible. In any case, what is demanded of her is self-forgetting and love. Montherlant consents to be moved by the woman who enables him to measure his virile power. Lawrence addresses an ardent hymn to the woman who renounces herself for him. Claudel exalts the vassal, servant, and devoted woman who submits herself to God by submitting herself to the male. Breton puts his hopes in woman for humanity's salvation, because she is capable of the most total love for her child and her lover. And even in Stendhal, the heroines are more moving than the masculine heroes, because they give themselves over to their passion with a more ardent violence. They help man to accomplish his destiny, as Prouez contributes to Rodrigo's salvation. In Stendhal's novels, women often save their lovers from ruin, prison, or death. Feminine devotion is demanded as a duty by Montholon and Lawrence. Less arrogant, Claudel, Breton, and Stendhal admire it as a generous choice. They desire it without claiming to deserve it. But, except for the astonishing Lamiel, all their works show they expect from woman this altruism that Comte admired in and imposed on her, and which, according to him, also constituted both a flagrant inferiority and an equivocal superiority. We could find many more examples. They would always lead to the same conclusions. In defining woman, each writer defines his general ethic and the singular idea he has of himself. It is also in her that he often registers the distance between his view of the world and his egotistical dreams. The absence or insignificance of the female element in a body of work, in general, is itself symptomatic. It has an extreme importance when it sums up in its totality all the aspects of the other, as it does for Lawrence. It remains important if woman is grasped simply as another, but the writer is interested in her life's individual adventure, which is Stendhal's case. It loses importance in a period like ours, in which each individual's particular problems are of secondary import. However, woman as other still plays a role, inasmuch as even to transcend himself, each man still needs to take consciousness of himself. Chapter 3. The myth of woman plays a significant role in literature, but what is its importance in everyday life? To what extent does it affect individual social customs and behavior? To reply to this question, we will need to specify the relation of this myth to reality. There are different kinds of myths. This one, sublimating an immutable aspect of the human condition, that is, the division of humanity into two categories of individuals, is a static myth. It projects into a Platonic heaven a reality grasped through experience or conceptualized from experience. For fact, value, significance, notion, and empirical law, it substitutes a transcendent idea, timeless, immutable, and necessary. This idea escapes all contention because it is situated beyond the given. It is endowed with an absolute truth. Thus, to the dispersed, contingent, and multiple existence of women, mythic thinking opposes the eternal feminine, unique and fixed. If the definition given is contradicted by the behavior of real flesh and blood women, it is women who are wrong. It is said not that femininity is an entity, but that women are not feminine. Experiential denials cannot do anything against myth, though in a way its source is in experience. It is thus true that woman is other than man, and this alterity is concretely felt in desire, embrace, and love. But the real relation is one of reciprocity. As such, it gives rise to authentic dramas. Through eroticism, love, friendship, and their alternatives of disappointment, hatred, and rivalry, the relation is a struggle of consciousness, each of which wants to be essential. It is the recognition of freedoms that confirm each other. It is the undefined passage from enmity to complicity. To posit the woman is to posit the absolute other, without reciprocity, refusing against experience, that she could be a subject, a peer. In concrete reality, women manifest themselves in many different ways, but each of the myths built around woman tries to summarize her as a whole. Each is supposed to be unique. The consequence of this is a multiplicity of incompatible myths, and men are perplexed before the strange inconsistencies of the idea of femininity. As every woman enters into many of these archetypes, each of which claims to incarnate its truth alone, men also find the same old confusion before their companions as did the sophists, who had difficulty understanding how a person could be light and dark at the same time. The transition to the absolute shows up in social representations. Relations are quickly fixed in classes and roles and types, just as, for the childlike mentality, relations are fixed in things. For example, patriarchal society, focused on preserving the patrimony, necessarily implies, in addition to individuals who hold and transmit goods, the existence of men and women who wrest them from their owners and circulate them. Men, adventurers, crooks, thieves, speculators, are generally repudiated by the group. Women, using their sexual attraction, can lure young people and even family men into dissipating their patrimony, all within the law. They appropriate men's fortunes or seize their inheritance. This role being considered bad, women who play it are called bad women. But in other families, those of their fathers, brothers, husbands, or lovers, they can in fact seem like guardian angels. The courtesan who swindles rich financiers is a patroness of painters and writers. The ambiguity of personalities like Aspasia and Madame de Pompadour is easy to understand as a concrete experience. But if woman is posited as the praying mantis, the mandrake, or the demon, then the mind reels to discover in her the muse, the goddess mother, and Beatrice as well. As group representation and social types are generally defined by pairs of opposite terms, ambivalence will appear to be an intrinsic property of the eternal feminine. The saintly mother has its correlation in the cruel stepmother. The angelic young girl has the perverse virgin. So mother will be said sometimes to equal life and sometimes death, and every virgin is either a pure spirit or flesh possessed by the devil. It is obviously not reality that dictates to society or individuals their choices between the two opposing principles of unification. In every period, in every case, society and individual decide according to their needs. Very often they project the values and institutions to which they adhere onto the myth they adopt. Thus, paternalism that calls for woman to stay at home defines her as sentiment, interiority, and immanence. In fact, every existent is simultaneously immanence and transcendence. When he is offered no goal, or is prevented from reaching any goal, or denied the victory of it, his transcendence